Hi everyone, it's Aliza Licht here, your host, and I'm so thrilled to share that my new book, On Brand, Shape Your Narrative, Share Your Vision, Shift Their Perception, is out now. I hope you'll pick up a copy because personal branding is for everyone. It's for the new graduate starting out, the middle manager looking to level up, the executive who wants to be a thought leader, the entrepreneur starting from scratch. It's for anyone who wants to pivot or transition into something new. Because having a strong personal brand means that your name gets dropped in rooms you're not in, and that you're thought of for opportunities that other people haven't even heard of yet. So pick up a copy, and I can't wait to hear what you think. Hi, this is Aliza Licht, and this is Leave Your Mark, the podcast, where I brew fresh career advice with some of my most inspiring and successful friends. It's professional advice that you can action immediately, whether you're just starting out in your career or well on your way. With a massive to-do list and a large cup of coffee, I promise that you can get it all done and still have time to post about it. Today, I am joined by Reshma Sajani, who needs no introduction. But for those of you who may not be aware, Reshma is a leading activist and the founder of Girls Who Code and Moms First. She is the author of Pay Up, The Future of Women in Work and Why It's Different Than You Think, as well as a book that I'm sure you know, Brave Not Perfect, Fear Less, Fail More, and Live Bolder. Reshma, you have spent more than a decade building movements to fight for women and girls' economic empowerment. You're working to close the gender gap in the tech sector, and most recently advocating for policies to support moms impacted by the pandemic. Of course, you're known for your influential TED Talk, Teach Girls Bravery, Not Perfection, which has more than 5 million views globally. You began your career as an attorney and a Democratic organizer, and you really surged onto the political scene as the first Indian American woman to run for U.S. Congress, which is amazing. Your approach to movement building has really been recognized broadly. I mean, you've been covered in Fortune World's Greatest Leaders, Fortune 40 Under 40, WSJ Magazine Innovator of the Year, Forbes Most Powerful Women Changing the World, Fast Company 100 Most Creative People. You are someone who really walks the walk, not just talks the talk. And I'm so excited to have you on the show. Truly honored.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm excited to be here and chat with you.
I'm excited to have you here. So I end every episode with the same question, which I'm going to start with today, because normally it's like, how do you want to leave your mark? And for you, it's kind of different because you have already made such an impact through your work. Like when you think about what you've been able to build, are you even surprised yourself at what you've been able to accomplish through both Girls Who Code and Moms First?
No, I feel like I'm not satisfied. I need to like spend more time in therapy. I don't feel like I'm done yet. I don't feel like it's solved yet. I don't feel like it's fixed yet. So no, I hope I feel that way. Like when I'm 80 and I'm sitting there and I have a moment, but I don't feel that way.
Okay. So I appreciate that. And I'm not terribly surprised that you would say that. But for everyone listening, just to give you a sense of Reshma's impact, Girls Who Code has taught over 500,000 girls through direct in-person computer science education programming. That's incredible. And not only that, but when you started Girls Who Code, you didn't even know how to code or run a nonprofit.
No, neither. But I saw a problem that I wanted to solve. And back then, people weren't talking about it. Like, it's not how coding is today, right? I was just visiting a school in Florida. They had like 7 coding clubs. You know, back then it was begging people, right, to launch a Girls Who Code club. So a lot has changed. I am proud that I do feel like we've been the driver of a lot of that change. But yeah, it's wild how much the culture has changed around this topic.
Well, you've certainly had a huge influence on that. But when you think back to like when you were starting, I mean, you literally pulled in what, 20 girls to help you start this. What was the biggest challenge with getting it off the ground? Because was there even an open to listen back then?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I feel like I'm like living it right now as I'm building my next nonprofit, Moms First. So I'm very much in the feels about like remembering what it was like, you know, now 11 years ago. I think one, it was that there wasn't an organization that was in this space. And so I had to kind of rebuild, like, what's the model? Like, if you were going to teach girls to code, how would you do that? What would be your approach? And I was like, oh, I would do it in the summer, because a lot of parents are looking for something for their kids to do during the summer. And there's time.
Smart.
You know, and so this idea of a summer camp. And then I also was like, oh, and it'd be really interesting to build that summer camp inside a tech company, because in 2010, all the rage was like Facebook and Instagram, and tech companies were cool. It was going to be an easier proposition to convince a teen girl to spend her summer inside a tech company with free snacks to learn how to code and do something that maybe she didn't think was actually all that cool. So I think in piecing together the model, there wasn't a comp for me. And I wanted Girls Who Code to be not just a nonprofit. I would say in many ways, I wanted to build a new model of what a nonprofit could look like, which was almost in many ways like a startup.
It's interesting because the issues, I mean, there's women going into tech, and then I'm on the board of the American Influencer Council. And we just had an event last week, which was talking about algorithm bias to creators of color, right? So there's so many obstacles. Like one of the engineers who was on the panel was saying that the amount of misogyny, even in her rise of like trying to learn this, was something that she really had to withstand. And you've been quoted as saying, if you're a woman in tech, stick with it. When you're feeling isolated or alone, stick with it. When you feel like you aren't qualified, stick with it. So if women are facing this, I mean, that's a really powerful statement, but how would you advise them to sort of power through that feeling of just like, why am I doing this? I don't want to be fighting uphill every day.
Yeah, listen, I think it's hard. So part of how I feel like I've penetrated this space is by creating my own spaces. So I often encourage women in tech, what's the company you want to create? What's the problem you want to solve? Because the reality is a lot of these companies like Meta, like Google, they were built without women. And now we're expecting them to suddenly embrace women and people of color when we were never part of their foundation or their creation. And I think what we found, even when you look at the recent tech layoffs, who got laid off? Women and people of color, right? Is that you can't change these organizations. It's too hard. And it might be impossible. So that doesn't mean, though, you step out of the space and you step out of the industry. It just means that you got to create your own thing. And I think what we need to do, as someone who now has created lots of her own things, is to teach women and people of color about, like, how do you do that and how to get over the fear and the moments of failure to actually have a shot at sticking with the thing that you love. Because when you decide you want to be an engineer or a coder, you do it because you love it. It's interesting to you. It's fun. And what's so sad is then you get that job, that first job, and you hate it. Not because you hate it anymore. You hate the place you work.
Mm-hmm. The people you work with, maybe.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great segue to your very well-known Failure Fridays. You're very transparent about your failures. What inspires you to share all of that?
Well, listen, I realize that I think failure is a privilege, and it's often a privilege for men. I think that when we think we can't fail, and we haven't been taught to fail, you know, my book, Brave Not Perfect, is really about this idea of, like, we've been socialized to be perfect. And so we've always, in many ways, moved away from failure because we felt like that failure was personal. So we gravitated away from the things that we thought we weren't good at. So we never even stepped into the arena of anything that we thought we couldn't do. And as someone who steps into the arena of a lot of things she can't do, it's such a gift. It's such a high, because failure teaches you how to be better. Like, I think about, like, Serena Williams, right? She sits at the edge of her ability, and a coach who says, do it again, do it again, do it again. She sits in her failure, and that's how she's the GOAT, right? So you can't be the GOAT if you actually don't fail. And so part of it means, though, that is that we got to start depersonalizing failure. And that's why I do these Failure Fridays, because I fail all the time, but people may look at me and think that my life is perfect. You know what I mean? And right. I get everything I want, and I don't, you know, have to deal with this. And so I want to tell the truth about my life and do that by really sharing these very public failures.
I'm curious, when you were growing up, what kind of kid were you?
I was naughty. I was like a rebel rouser, you know, but I was also the same person I am today. Like, I led my first march when I was 13 years old. There wasn't a mic that I didn't love. You know, I loved to publicly speak. I loved to organize. I was always passionate about injustice. It's like in my soul. You know what I mean? Yesterday, I read an article that I just can't stop thinking about the CDC and a study that they did on teen girls and how 1 out of 3 teen girls has seriously contemplated suicide. And it's funny, I would have thought that the older I got, the more I read, that it was have desensitized me. And it's actually the opposite. So it kind of begins with how you started this, why I don't feel good about what I've accomplished, because I still feel like we're oppressed.
Yeah.
It just is in the fire of my belly, in particular when I see injustice against women and girls, to fight and to fight back. And I've always been like that as a kid. And I don't know why. I think it's just like I was born to do this work.
I mean, you clearly were, but it's interesting because when we think about career pivots, right? You started in law, you went into finance, you went to tech, then you went into politics. Obviously, you're someone who is confident in your decisions, but what is your mental filter for deciding, okay, it's time to do X. It's time to move from this thing and move to the next thing.
So it used to be that I just was looking for the biggest credential. Oh, I got to go to Yale because, I mean, if I go to Yale, then people will think I'm smart. Oh, it's 2010. I got to work in hedge funds because everybody's working in hedge funds. I was chasing shiny objects and getting notches on my belt. And I was miserable because it was crushing my soul. The thing, though, that I always wanted to do was be a public servant. I always wanted to run for office. I always saw myself in Washington as a Congress lady. Everything was about getting to that place. And so when I tried to go for that and I lost, it was really crushing. And I would say it's one of the most kind of foundational moments in my life because I had to really, and I still have to really confront the job that I thought I was supposed to have and the job I still don't have. And the job sometimes I think I say I don't want, but do I want it? Or am I just afraid to go for it? It's this really big piece in my life. But I think what's happened is the older I've gotten, I've stopped chasing shiny things. There's actually nothing I want. There's not an award I want. There's not a job I want. There's not a title. There's nothing I actually want. The only thing I want now is to really pass policy and see the kind of cultural change that I've seen with Girls Who Code, now with moms. But I don't want things. And I used to want things. And I don't know what changed that. I think it's age. It just, one day I stopped being that person.
But I think that's amazing that you can reflect and recognize that and realize that you're in a different place. I mean, let's talk about moms first, because obviously, you know, this was born out of crisis. You're super passionate and you're an activist on making sure that there is equality and women are paid for what they're doing. And there's so much on our moms today. How do you see moms first versus Girls Who Code at this point in your life? Could you run again to like really stand for this particular topic?
I don't know if I want to, because I think part of the problem is I still feel like I'm making more of a change running on movement than being in Congress.
Right.
I feel like I have more power than I do if I was a junior congressperson or even maybe a junior senator, right? And so someone would have to convince me otherwise, and I'm not convinced. It's funny because I feel like, okay, so I guess I've never really talked about it, but I feel like with Girls Who Code, in many ways, the choice was made for me. I lost the congressional race. So I'm like, oh, I guess I'm building this nonprofit. I remember one time a board member had said to me, well, this wasn't the job you wanted, you know? And there was some truth to that back then. I wanted to build Moms First. I could have run for office. And I chose to build Moms First. So it's in many ways different because I'm choosing. But spiritually, it feels like I'm living the exact same experience. It's like I'm moving this mountain up a tree. I got my tin cup up there raising money. You know what I mean? I'm hiring my first team, figuring out the right messaging, you know, having these really tough conversations with people who don't fully understand what it is or what I'm doing or why it's a big deal. And that was very much how Girls Who Code was. But the sense, similarly, where it's unicorns and rainbows, where it's like Lizzo's emailing you being like, let me honor you on stage. You know what I mean? And so it's just also the world conspiring to say, go build this, go build this, go build this, go build this. It's hard because it's always hard when you're doing something hard, but it's not like I'm pushing a boulder off a cliff and it feels right. And I have lots of projects in my life where it feels like it's just not working. It's not happening. You know what I mean? It's just, I'm pushing a boulder off a cliff.
Well, this work resonates with everyone, and it's important work. Your book, Pay Up, which I think is also extremely timely and important for everyone listening, Pay Up confronts the big lie of corporate feminism and presents a bold plan to address the burnout and inequality harming America's working women today. And you really do debunk the myth that women can have it all. And you take the reader really through these four steps of creating change, which is empowering working women, educating corporate leaders, revising the narratives about what it means to be successful, and advocating for policy. But on this show, because Leave Your Mark is, you know, freshly brewed career advice, I would love to dig a little deeper into the educating corporate leaders, because that seems like such a no-brainer.
Yeah.
What do you want corporate leaders to know, to think about? Because then it's that grassroots of like, okay, if everyone did that,
yeah,
what would happen?
Well, I just feel like I was just educating corporate leaders before we got on this call right now. I mean, part of it is just one saying, throw out your ERG playbook. Because what you've been telling women to do is, oh, if you got a mentor, if you got a sponsor, if you just leaned in a little bit more, you know what I mean? If you got some confidence, you too would have the corner office. That's never been the problem. We are all good. We're still getting straight A's at work. The problem is the minute I become a caregiver, whether it's for my elderly parent, whether it's for my child, I suddenly find myself doing 2.5 jobs in a workplace that doesn't support me, that judges me, that penalizes me. And I need the structures to change, right? So to me, it's about having companies recognize that that's the change that we have to make. Now, the resistance to that change is they think that that's expensive. The data doesn't back up their beliefs. Similar to diversity and inclusion. If one more person asked me to prove why, you know, diversity and inclusion is like, I'm going to like lose my mind, because there's plenty of studies. You just don't believe them. So let's talk about that, right? So similarly here, let's talk about flexibility. Like, it has been proven, right, from the Fed that people are actually more productive working from home. But still, there's a myth out there that if I'm working like this, I'm like sitting in my couch drinking bonbons and watching Netflix instead of working, right? So the fact that you're spying on me, that's how much you don't believe it. And so how do you change that? Because we know for women in particular, right after they have a child, they need that flexibility. They need that ability to work from home, to touch them. I mean, I have a 2-year-old, 3-year-old now that has horrible asthma. So every 3 weeks, we're back in this thing. And I don't know when it's going to happen. Like, I woke up this morning, I'm like, there's the cough. There's the thing. You're not going to school today. I'm working from home. I got to redo my whole schedule, right? And of course I'm going to make that choice because that is my baby.
But you can make that
choice. But I can because I work for myself.
Right.
And everybody on my team can. And we know that that's all you need. But we keep resisting that. And we resist it because we think about economically, I'm sitting eating bonbons. So that's really what we have to change, is this sentiment. So that's why I talk about this, not in terms of this is the right thing to do for mothers. I mean, that's what I'm saying to you, but I talk about it in terms of this makes economic sense. It just doesn't make sense that every year, you know, like women in tech, we lose 50% of women in tech by the time they're 3 years into their job because of this issue, you know? And so you're actually wasting money on this incredibly talented workforce that you're not solving for. Like, that's just basic. We know that women leave when they have children, not because they want to, because they have to. And we would retain them if we actually just provided them support. Boom. Easy.
And I could not agree more. I mean, I have 2 kids. When I first had my son, I worked from home on Wednesdays. This is way back in the day before anyone worked from home. And then when I had my daughter, I worked from home 2 days a week. And I'll never forget the CEO at the time, when it came around to bonus time, he said to my boss, oh, but she's part-time. And she's like, she works full-time. She works full-time. She just works from home 2 days. And it was a big stigma. I didn't deserve my full bonus because I was home those 2 days. So I get it.
It's still like that.
Yeah.
And so that's the thing that we have to change. And that's why I think in many ways we talk about this as the future of work. What do we want workplaces to look like? We want workplaces to allow for flexibility in remote work. We want workplaces to not think that you shouldn't be denied your bonus because you're not really working, even though we're working, right? And so to me, I feel like all of the energy and time needs to be placed on that, on this issue, and not other ones. And childcare is a big piece of that. That's really, to me, at the center of like our first test, which is like, we know that women are not returning back to work because the cost childcare because childcare is unavailable and unaffordable. And so how do we see childcare the way that we saw, quite frankly, IVF? It's wild to me that 5 years ago, less than 1% of companies paid for IVF. Now every Fortune 500 company does, because you want to delay pregnancy because you think that you will actually help you retain women in the workforce. Same argument for childcare. But on the flip side, when you do have a baby, same reason why you should pay for childcare, because it will help you retain women in the workforce. And so how do we see it on the same footing that we start to think about this as a benefit, an economic benefit that we need to provide to maintain and retain women in the workforce?
I mean, so many people, especially like I come from fashion, no one had babies until much later on because we weren't basically allowed to, right? Yeah. I mean, you were in Europe for 3 months, you couldn't possibly have a baby. What can someone do in their own work situation to advocate for the stuff that comes up? Like I was just actually with Dee in the moms we thing before. And a lot of the moms were saying like, these parents are showing up to like every single game during the day and every single thing during the workday. Like, I don't understand like how they can, like, I literally don't, I can't be at work and also be at someone's game. So it's like beyond even childcare, because it's also just the sheer demands of being a parent, or if you're schlepping your kids around to like 50 million sports games, it's like you can't cut yourself into 50 pieces. And having empathy to understand the schedule itself, forget about the finances of it, the schedule of being a working parent, it does fall on the moms.
It 100% falls on us because we're the ones. But I also think the opportunity that we have to have before we even start changing things is to say to ourselves, what do you want? My girlfriend and I were just talking about this. And I said to her, you know, I really realized that like, I don't want to be the parent that's at every PTA meeting, but I want to be the parent that has my one-on-one time with my kid. And so for me, it's like, I want to be able to choose and to curate, right? The life that I want and not feel guilt on either side.
Yeah.
Not feel judgment for not showing up to the mystery reading thing that's at 12 o'clock during the day. And not feeling judgment for not flying to Geneva on like a week's notice, you know, because my kid needs me. So I want to decide myself what I want. And I think that that's where we have to kind of get to is this conversation with people like, what do you want? So I was coaching the Most Powerful Women this year, and I was talking about the guilt that I have. My son loves to give me guilt when I leave. And all the other moms, the CEOs in the room were saying, well, don't worry about it. He won't remember. But I remember sitting there thinking, no, well, I'm going to remember. So the advice is typically like, go do work because don't worry about that. They'll be fine. But that's not the advice that I want right now. The advice that I actually want right now is, what do you want? What do you want, Reshma? And I think what I know I want is I want to be able to spend quality time with my kids, which means I love nighttime because that's when I hear all the secrets. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
I love being around sometimes during the day because I can like pop down and give a squeeze hug or make sure he's eating. I want to be able to do a tennis game with my son on the weekends because that's our bonding. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I want to curate what I want. And that means that I'm not going to be on a plane every week. That means that I'm not doing work on the weekends. So what do you want? No judgment. You know what I mean? And then how do I actually balance my life and my schedule for that?
I love that mentality. And I think that we're probably our own biggest judgers.
Yeah.
I think it's really important. I mean, listen, mom guilt is
real.
It's real. Some people just don't feel it though. I don't know. There are some people who are like
my husband.
Okay. There you go. My husband too.
They don't feel it. They are living exactly what I just described. And they're good dads.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Like, I realized, I mean, I want to be my husband. Like, I want to be him because you're a good dad. My kids love you. You have a good life. You're happy. You're joyful. You have hobbies and you crush at work. Like, what the fuck am I doing? Because he's not my, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yes, they're wired differently.
It's not about being more like men, but it's about like looking at the way he makes those kinds of daily decisions that I feel like I want to do more. But I think part of it too is I do, like yesterday, I was like kind of done with a meeting a little bit early at that right time to pick up my son from school. And I kind of wanted to take him for ice cream for Valentine's Day. And it was like, oh, I'm doing this because I want to do it. not because I feel guilty. And it felt really good.
Yeah. And you know what? I think that our husbands are also deciding what they do based on what they want to do also. And they're perfectly good with it. I mean, I think that's really, really accurate. One of your earlier books, Women Don't Wait in Line, had the subtitles, Break the Mold, Lead the Way, which I love. I love the whole thing. I love Women Don't Wait in Line. I hate waiting in line. But so many people, so many women don't believe they deserve to like take up that space, right?
Yeah.
Or they're not at that level. They should be waiting in line. So when you thought of that book title, who were you hoping reads that book? And what were you trying to convey at like a macro level?
I was this upstart that was running for office against a 19-year incumbent. And I was really active in politics. And I felt like everyone was like, you should run one day. You should run one day. You should run one day. But then when I decided to run, the response was, you should wait your turn. You should wait your turn. And I was shocked. This idea of like waiting your turn and waiting in line was something very gendered. We didn't tell men to do that. So that's what inspired me to write the book, because I often do think that we tell women to wait their turn and that they're not ready. And so we never actually then take the plunge because we never really feel like we're ready, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of times I'm sure girlfriends that you have who are just phenomenal, amazing, brilliant, smart, and they're unhappy in their current work position and they have a dream, but they can't talk themselves in a frenzy to do that thing because they're, again, have that voice in their head saying, it's not time yet. You're not ready. And so how do you get that voice to shut up? You get it to shut up by really taking big leaps and making big moves like I did running for Congress. It was a move that I made that scared the hell out of me. And when it didn't work out, I was like, oh, it didn't break me. And that aha moment of that is why we need to not wait our turns. Because you need that to then get to where you're supposed to get to in life. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Are you the kind of person where you're always looking for the hard things to do? You strike me
as... I love hard, yes.
You love hard things.
True.
So you manage failure. You have a very busy schedule. You're incredibly successful. You're a mom, wife, etc. How do you coach yourself back from feeling overwhelmed?
Oh, I'm bad at it. It's like right now, it's like I'm miserable. I'll be honest. This has been a rough year.
You don't seem miserable.
I know, but I am. Meaning like it's a lot. You know, my kid's been on and off sick the whole year. There's just a lot of, I'm a little woo-woo. So there's like just a lot of weird energy in the air. Energetically, things feel off. And then it's really hard to build a venture. Raising money is hard. The team's hard. Everything, the messaging is hard. Everything's hard. You're right. I do like it hard, theoretically. I don't like easy things. But in a moment, like my husband teases me, he's always like, your face is always like, you know what I mean? Like
a default setting.
It's true. Like that's how I kind of feel. But at the same time, I'm excited. It's weird. It's complicated, right? And I feel like I'm like entering perimenopause, right? So it's like physically, I feel a little off. So I was talking to my coach and she was just saying, you know, part of it is just acknowledging that you're in a new cycle. And so you need to make some adjustments. And so, you know, some of the adjustments I've made this year is I just have really clamped down, and maybe this is the wrong thing, but I've clamped down on my social life. So I just can't do like the dinners and the events and the things all week long. So I've been kind of shutting down at 6, doing nothing at night, and then going to bed at 8:45. And I've been doing that pretty much since the beginning of the year. And I feel really good.
That's amazing. Listen, my theme for 2023, I always have one word theme. And my theme this year is impact, because I'm being very judgmental, same way, about like, if I'm going to do that thing, why am I doing it? What is the impact of that? Because agreed. And maybe it is like post-pandemic of just like, we're all really tired.
Yeah.
Like, we're tired. It's hard to be out and about all the time. So I totally respect that. And I'm glad it's working for you.
Yeah, it's working. I'm really happy. And I think it's hard to solve tough problems when you're always scheduled. I need thinking time.
That is very true.
And creative time. I know I need to do that this year. And so far it's working out. And look, I mean, I think energetically, I was talking to a friend of mine about this yesterday. I'm like, why is everyone so miserable this year? And it just feels like everybody's just having a bad year. What is that about? Is that about COVID, not recovering, not processing? And I think it's also about the fact that people feel less connected. We're just not connected in the same way. And I think acknowledging where and how you need those forms of connection and how to find them and do it on your terms. You know, so for me, it may not be at a cocktail party at 7. You know, it may be through a religious class I'm taking on Zoom. So I'm doing it in my pajamas, but I'm still feeling connected to people in the conversation. So yeah, I mean, I think paying attention to how people are feeling is really important.
Yeah. And I think it goes full circle back to what you said before, which is asking yourself what you want.
Yeah.
And then delivering on that. I think it's great. Reshma, you're an inspiration. I mean, even though it's a hard year and even though obviously what you're doing is a very challenging problem, you really are speaking the language that everyone else is feeling, and you're representing millions of women around the world. So keep doing what you're doing. Thanks for coming on Leave Your Mark.
Thanks so much for listening to Leave Your Mark, the podcast. If you want more career advice, be sure to pick up a copy of my best-selling book, Leave Your Mark. If you're on Instagram, make sure to follow at Leave Your Mark Podcast to stay up with the latest episodes. And of course, say hi to me at Aliza Licht XO. If you're on Twitter, definitely reach out at Aliza Licht. I would love to hear from you. If you want to subscribe to my newsletter or attend a future virtual mentoring event, go to alizalicht.com for more information. And just remember this, if change doesn't hurt a little, it's not change. Keep on rocking.